From WBEZ Chicago and PRX, this is Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. This week, we're talking about the 25th anniversary of Wayne's World with the film's director, Penelope Spheeris.
It all came together in some sort of magical way where the planets were lined up right, the chemistry of the right people, everybody was at the peak of their game. Very seldom in life did things line up like that.
And we'll review Everything Now, the new album from Arcade Fire. That's all coming up on Sound Opinions. You're listening to Sound Opinions, and we'll get to our conversation with director Penelope Spheeris soon. But first, we've got a new album to review, Greg.
That is Everything Now, the title track from the fifth studio album from Arcade Fire, one of the leading independent rock bands in the world, now signed with a major label, Columbia Records Artists, Arcade Fire. Formed in Montreal in 2001, debut album in 2004, Funeral, was gushingly reviewed in the indie press and became one of the best-selling indie rock records of its time. They followed up with Neon Bible in 2008. The Suburbs was the big mainstream breakthrough. It was a surprise winner of the 2011 Grammy Album of the Year. Followed up in 2013 with kind of a left turn, a record that probably the first crack in the armor, so to speak. Here was a disco-y record that got some mixed reviews for the first time in the band's career. It was called Reflector, and now 4 years later, we have the fifth studio album, Everything Now. It was produced by Thomas Bangalter of Daft Punk and Pulp bassist Steve Mackey. We're going to play a track from it before we review it. It's called Signs of Life from Arcade Fire, Everything Now on Sound Opinions.
Those cool kids stuck in the past, palm ends of cigarette ash. Wait outside until it begins. Won't be the first ones in. Spend your life waiting in line. You find it hard to define, but you do it all the time. And you do it again. Looking for signs of life. Looking for signs every night, but there's no signs of life. So we do it again. Looking for signs of life. Looking for signs every night, but there's no signs of life. So we do it again. First kiss tastes like cigarettes. Dead men walking, take your best. Once again, you lost your friends. Around and around again. Those cool kids stuck in the past. Palm mints of cigarette ash. Where we going? Who did you ask? Those cool kids stuck in the past, in a world of cigarette ash. Where we going? Who did you ask? Who did you ask? Looking for signs of life. Looking for signs every night, but there's no signs of life. So we do it again. Sick. Looking for signs of life. Looking for signs of life. Looking for signs every night, but there's no signs of life. So we do it again.
Signs of Life by Arcade Fire from the new album Everything Now. Greg, I do love that track, and I love the title track, Everything Now. I don't necessarily love the first reprise or the second reprise of the title track. There are theoretically 13 songs on this record, but really only 10, because in grand, overstated, dare I say, bombastic fashion, Arcade Fire has these couple of songs come back and forth. Look, people have been groomed from the beginning of this band to hear their new work as massive statements, all right? Not for nothing did they open shows for U2 a while back. They've got a touch of that arena thing in them. I think generally it has worked in their favor because despite this huge sound, there's always been an intellectual substance and an emotional core. That is less so on this album, not for lack of trying. I think this is the most ordinary collection of songs Arcade Fire ever has given us. And there are some very, very good songs. Everything Now, Sign of Life, I'm loving those. They are daring, I think, in that Achtung Baby U2 way to even laugh at themselves. On Creature Comfort, Wynn Butler tells us about a girl who dreams of dying all the time, possibly considering suicide. She filled up the bathtub and put our first record on.
Assisted suicide. She dreams about dying all the time. She told me she came so close, filled up the bathtub and put on our first record.
From any other band, I don't think that would be funny. But from they're laughing at themselves. Their breakthrough was Funeral, okay? I think laughing at themselves is good. I think their turn toward dance music on Reflector was good. There were more ambitious things going on with Reflector, though. Whether it was the New Orleans second line thing or the Haitian percussion that they were incorporating, here we just have a lot of songs that wish they were ABBA songs. The best of them are, and the rest kind of falls short. I've got three songs that give me hives, I swear. So at its best, on the buy it, try it, trash it scale, I got to say this is a try it Arcade Fire record.
Yeah, Jim, at Twitter language, meh, you know, this is
yeah.
One. This is a meh album. It's I'd add another couple of songs that don't work for me in addition to the ones that you'd mentioned. Infinite Content, both versions of that song.
Infinite Content.
It's pretty slick.
But it's a good intellectual idea lyrically, because what Wynn is singing about is we are now at such saturation point in the digital media universe that it's like, his quote, every song ever is playing at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, the concept of we're overstimulated but under-inspired.
Yeah.
I seem to recall Radiohead, delving into this topic about 20 years ago.
No, they're the
or
masters.
Granddaddy, you know, with the software slump. It's been around. It's not a new topic. But mostly what I'm not hearing is inspiration musically. I think they're sort of searching around for new sounds and not necessarily getting there. You've got some experimentation with reggae dancehall. You've got horns prominently figuring on a record and not to the best effect. Disco-y vibes, those are in the air. LCD Sound System is back,
yeah.
And so is Spoon experimenting with dance rhythms.
You know, it's a little too much Casey and the Sunshine Band and not enough Chic.
You know, exactly. It is sort of a second-rate disco record in some ways. It is not something that makes me want to get on the dance floor. It's kind of like, yeah, they sound like white guys trying to be a disco band, you know? It's not exactly connecting on that level. But there are a couple of brilliant pop moments, undeniable. I think Creature Comfort's a great song. I love those Blade Runner synths. I think they've made a line for the year, God make me famous. If you can't, just make it painless. That's a pretty good line, you know, summing up the concerns of a generation in a way about what this life is leading to. So there are moments on this record that are great, but there are not enough of them mm-hmm. to truly make it a great Arcade Fire record. So it was a try it for me.
A double try it from us on the new Arcade Fire. But what are your thoughts about this record? We want to hear from you. Call and leave a message on our hotline, 888-859-1800. After a break, we'll talk with Wayne's World director, Penelope Spheris. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.
It's been getting so hard living with the things you do to me. My dreams are getting so strange, like to tell you everything I see. I see a man at the back, as a matter of fact, his eyes are as red as the sun. And a girl in the corner that don't ignore, cause she's
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Codd here with Jim DeRogatis, and that's a little snippet of the theme song used for the 1992 film Wayne's World, directed by our guest today, Penelope Spheeris. Now, Penelope, she began her directing career filming shorts with the great Albert Brooks on Saturday Night Live.
Many people don't even know that.
Yeah, it's an amazing little anecdote about her career. And after getting sort of burned out on that Hollywood scene, she started making independent documentaries, a game changer, The Decline of Western Civilization, beginning in 1981.
You know, The Decline, Part One, Greg, is one of the all-time great punk rock films. Entertaining for different reasons was Part Two, which looked at the developing hair metal scene. I didn't like it for the music, but Penelope caught a different version of the rock dream very convincingly in that film. And then there's even a third, Decline of Western Civilization, where she looks at gutter punk. I think that's more of a work of sociology and great kind of street journalism than it is music. But clearly, to the core of her being, this woman is a rock fan. She got a call back when from Lorne Michaels of SNL to direct the film version of what had been a successful skit, Wayne's World. Two guys, Mike Myers, Dana Carvey, sitting in the basement pretending to be zonked out heavy metal fans, right? How do you make this into a movie? People were kind of wary about that. But the 1992 film, I'm sorry, it's one of the all-time classics in pop culture, certainly in rock and roll. Penelope, we are honored to have you on, the director of Wayne's World and so much else. Welcome to Sound Opinions.
Well, thank you very much.
When you were making Wayne's World, all right, It's early on in your career. It's Mike Myers' first movie. You know, did you ever think that decades later people would hold it in such esteem and want to be talking to you about it, you know, as if it was Citizen Kane?
No, it never occurred to me or any of us that it would actually hold up this long. It's been amazing. People still love it. It's crazy.
What do you think it is? Greg and I have hosted this show with two guys talking about music they love for 12 years now. Obviously, we have a fondness of thinking about, two doofuses in on the couch talking about music they love. You know, how do you make a movie
out of
that?
It was a sketch. It was a Saturday Night Live sketch, right? And you turned it into a whole movie. I mean, did you think it had that kind of potential?
That was the big fear that the studio, Paramount, had, was how are you going to make a movie out of that little sketch? And, you know, Bonnie and Terry Turner, the writers, and Mike, and Dana as well, I mean, we all pitched in to try to, you know, make it as funny and rich and cool of a movie as possible. But we never thought it would make the money that it did. We never thought 25 years later people would still be talking about it. We just wanted to get through to the end of the shoot, you know?
I mean, not a huge budget, $14 million. It ends up making $180 million and counting. Since then, and it continues to be shown to a capacity audience. I hope you're getting some of the residuals on that, Penelope, by the way. I hope you're still getting paid for that
movie.
Well,
here's the thing. When Paramount was going to do the movie, it didn't even remotely occur to them that it may have this kind of box office or staying power. So they were generous enough to give me a large percentage of it, and I'm actually really, really rich.
That's refreshing, because we talked to the Spinal Tap fellows.
Oh, yeah.
Who
got screwed.
Didn't make a dime off of that movie.
Is that right?
The second greatest movie of
rock history.
Yeah,
I almost directed that one, too. But here's the thing. I feel very fortunate that, we lucked out with the movie and that my agent was smart enough to say, hey, give her a percentage, and that Paramount's still sending the checks. It's like, I was raised in a trailer park, you know. It's like I didn't have any money, and I didn't make any money until I was like 45 years old when I did Wayne's World. You know, I get all these people saying, oh, what am I going to do, man? I'm in the movie business, and I can't make any money. And I'm like, you're 20 years old. Come back when you're 45, dude.
Patience and perseverance.
That's right.
Let's go back to the beginning, Penelope. You grew up in New Orleans?
Actually, I was born in New Orleans, and my father owned a carnival, and my mom was the ticket taker, and we traveled all through the South. So all of us four kids were born in different states, like, that. You know, whenever she was going to pop one, they'd stop, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. And then get right back on the road.
And get back right on the road. There you go.
What are your earliest memories of falling in love with music? Because with the Decline films, with the use of the soundtrack, and everything you've done has this musical consciousness. Do you remember when you fell in love with music?
I think probably around the same time most people do. You know, it's that those teenage year, early, like tweener kind of years, you know, where you're just trying to find your identity and everything. And for me, luckily, it was like right around when rock and roll first started. So, you know, I had Elvis and Chuck Berry and all the classics, you know, and that's when I was 10, 11 years old. So I'm like, yeah, I'm in, you know. And that's when it started. And I think as time went on and my mother started getting married to the tune of 9 times total, I would like have difficult times during that growing up. And so I would turn to music and find comfort. And I think that's what happens with a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You obviously were hugely interested in the film medium. You started working on Saturday Night Live and did those shorts with Albert Brooks, which really started both of your careers, two extraordinary careers starting in this place. And I remember those Brooks shorts as being extraordinary. Like, what, you know, it was a little bit of a different flavor for that show at that time.
First today, we'll visit comedy take class. Here the students practice all kinds of takes. The double take, the elbow take, and today, they're working on the spit take.
All right, now that was pretty good, but I'd like to try it just one more time in the same way. Now remember, I've just walked into the room. Now start to drink. Good. Now I speak. Guess what? I just heard from the bank, and not only don't you have any money, but your sister is dead.
Did you always see yourself as a filmmaker who incorporated music, or did you want a music career at any point?
No, here's the thing. Back in the day, you know, being a woman, you didn't even dare say you were going to be a director, okay? Mm. So I was in film school in the late 60s, early 70s, and then right after that, I met Lorne, and he introduced me to Albert. He calls me up, and he goes, hey, Penelope, I found this guy, and he's really funny. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't know how to make movies, and you do, so will you show him? And I said, I said, of course I will. And so that's how I started producing those shorts for Albert. But I have to thank Albert, because he really taught me a lot about Hollywood, because I didn't know anything about it. And, you know, he taught me how to be neurotic. Like, if you're in a room for 4 years, that's what it was with Albert Brooks, you walk out nuts, okay? And then I worked with Richard Pryor, actually, before I even worked with Albert. I don't know how this happened to me in my life, but I ended up with a lot of amazing comedians, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Not easy people to work with, I imagine, because all perfectionists, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, the thing is, I figured out, you know, that it's a cross between insanity and genius, you know? And I think it works really well together when people that are crazy geniuses are creative, you know? And I mean, that certainly applies, I think, to, and I mean that as a compliment, you know, I don't mean it as an insult, because I like crazy and I like genius, you know, and I like those kind of people. But I've been fortunate enough to work with Mike Myers and a lot of other people.
Knowing that you came up with Elvis and Chuck Berry and 50s rock, there's a thing in certain people's lives where they stop listening at a certain point. And yet, if we just look at the three Decline of Western Civilization films, you know, punk comes along, you're not freaked out, you want to understand it. And you make one of the best films about punk rock ever. You know, hair metal is happening, the metal stuff is on in the late 80s, and you want to understand it. Same thing with gutter punk. You know, it seems like you're almost sociologically minded. You said before that in those difficult days of your mom's remarriages, you know, you found comfort in music. You want to understand the musical communities that come up, I've always thought.
Yeah, the culture and also just understand human behavior. You know, I think at the core of my filmmaking is just trying to understand why we humans behave the way we do, you know. For me, it's like that's the most important part, and the music is a way to show it, you know. My interpretation of different generations, just cultures, you know.
Why did you cut your hair like that?
Because I'm searching.
He knows where it's. He knows where it's at now.
And I'm looking for something.
And where it's at is to search. He's tried. So far, he's tried. He's tried punk rock. He's tried.
Jesus.
What are you searching for?
I really don't know. Now I'll know when I find it.
Was there a moment when you said, I've got to do this movie? I'm talking about your directorial debut, The Decline of Western Civilization, 1981. You know, punk rock wasn't exactly like a hot ticket. You know, I'm going to make millions doing this punk rock movie.
No.
And yet, you know, you're one of the primary documents of a very important part of L.A. music's evolution. And in that scene in particular, you got all the important bands, Black Flag and Circle Jerks and X and Fear, Germs, mm-hmm. in that movie. Was there a moment when you said, I've got to do this? I mean, do you remember how that sort of evolved into a movie?
You know, it was crazy because I was working with Albert, and Albert and all of his buddies, you know, it was James Brooks and Billy Crystal and Rob Reiner, and we were all hanging out together. And Albert was saying, oh, I'm such a great producer. And they said, why don't you go over and try and get this gig doing this Goldie Hawn movie at Warner Brothers called Private Benjamin. And I said, you know what? I'm not really down with this producing thing because it was really getting hard there working with Albert. So I said, I'm going to direct a punk rock movie and a documentary. And they laughed so hard at me. they made fun of me, honestly, because they're comedians and they like to make fun of people. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of hard to keep going. But I knew that I had this intense interest in not only the music, but this new kind of culture, because punk rock, I think, changed everything when it happened in the late 70s.
Were you immersed in the club scene? Did you go out and see bands quite a bit during that period of time? How did you come across? Because it was almost like you had to know where to go. I mean, these gigs weren't like well publicized. You would find a flyer on a lamppost, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
how
was it?
There
that
was
you
no social media.
Right. How were you sort of engaged with that scene?
Well, I was very much engaged with it before I thought to make the movie, you know? Mm-hmm. And it was actually sort of I took the nosedive into Hollywood working with Albert and Lauren, and then I've always kind of had, you know, that outcast one foot in the left side of the world because of being on the carnival, you know. And so when I saw the punks, I'm like, I kind of relate to these guys more than I do Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
So I started, you know, I had a music video company back then called Rock and Reel. I think it was the only one around, really. And I was shooting music videos for the record company, so I had equipment all the time. And so I would shoot, you know, Seals and Crofts and Fleetwood Mac and Funkadelic and Doobie Brothers and stuff like that. And then at night I would go out and shoot punk rock.
That's great.
That sounds like good times. Funkadelic to the Germs.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've had, you know, I've been in a prison. No, I wasn't in prison, but I've been in a prison in Rahway Prison in New Jersey doing the Lifers Group, it was called. Mm. It was these rappers that were in there for life for murder. I mean, I've been all over the place shooting music, you know.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. It's taken you literally around the world.
It totally has, yeah. Definitely has.
So, Penelope, if you had to choose, what sounds are closest to your heart? You know, what would you take to the desert island of, you know, would it be the metal stuff? Would it be the punk stuff? You know, would it be, I mean, you did a
that's
Ozfest
a really interesting question. That's an interesting question. Desert island boombox. Let me concentrate here. I'm going to say Japanese Zen music. And I'm not kidding. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, here's the thing. Me and my boyfriend, who was a gutter punk on Decline 3 that I've known for 20 years, we went out on the Ozfest with Sharon and Ozzy. I said to my boyfriend a couple years ago, I'm like, how come we don't go out to concerts anymore? And he goes, well, once you've been to 30 cities on the Ozfest, you don't even care anymore.
Yeah, I suppose you can overdose after a while.
Well, yeah. I mean, I still, you know, every once in a while I'll throw on some punk rock or some metal or some Norman Greenbaum, Spirit in the Sky or whatever, you know, but it's not like I've got to have my punk rock. I feel like at heart I am a punk, you know, that's just what I am, but I don't sit around, you know, listening to punk all day and spitting at people.
Reggae! I can do catch a Reggae! Reggae!
Well, as a documentarian, you said you wanted to learn about these cultures, about, you know, what made them tick. Why were people motivated to create in this way, a clearly non-commercial way? What did you learn about the punks after you did the first Decline movie?
Well, you know, back then everybody was just trying to change things because you got to remember it was disco all over the place. And music sucked, and look at the clothes. I mean, look at people's hair, you know what I mean? It's like they just wanted to flip it on its head, you know, and just change things, everything. And so music changed because of punk rock. I think attitudes toward women changed. I think politics changed. I think so many different things. It's certainly a different visual today. When you drive down the street and you see some kid on a skateboard, you know, he looks the way he does because of punk rock, you know?
Mm-hmm. And these bands were, you know, kind of out there on a limb. I think they lived very, they were not viewed as law-abiding citizens. They were viewed as a threat.
Oh, people were afraid of them.
The audience was afraid. The police were, you know, out to get them. That was kind of the viewpoint in the culture.
The parents were about ready to just kill themselves. Mm, you know?
Right, right.
Because the visual of a punk rock back then was shocking, you know? Mm-hmm. Punk rock person back then, it was just like, it sent fear through the straight people, and that's exactly what they wanted to do.
Why do you wear those clothes like that?
I'm comfortable.
At one time, maybe I was considered different, but now I'm in a comfortable lifestyle, and I can be myself.
Everyone's hair should be blue, because that's the best color. It looks so good.
You know, like when I first showed The Decline, the very first screening was at the Writers Guild, and the lady stood up after the film was over, and she said, "How dare you glorify these heathens?"
Tipper Gore was her name, actually.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. No, that was with the second film.
Yeah. And did you, as a woman, Penelope, did you ever have any trouble connecting, whether it's the hyper macho Kiss, you know, or any of the punk bands? I mean, they just seemed awkward around women. You know, the metal, many of those metal bands that you dealt with, not Saint Lemmy, but, you know, Aerosmith and Kiss. I mean, they
actually, it's funny you mentioned Lemmy, because I would say that in all, I love Lemmy, okay, in all of the musicians I've ever dealt with, he's the only one that tried to strangle me, literally.
Wow.
I know.
We're laughing, but that sounds serious.
That sounds like a compliment. He thought you were an equal.
I think that might be a compliment, yeah, but it was freaky because it was took me up, you know, by surprise. I was just finished shooting, and somebody actually took a picture of it, and that's why I'm for sure it happened, because he grabbed me from behind and started strangling with his elbow around my neck. And I'm,
wow. Yeah.
I don't know if this is love or hate, but it sure is freaky.
The only thing you see.
Yeah, but so you were dealing with so many sexually awkward young boys, you know, and that brings us back to Wayne's World too. How do you relate, you know, to these two doofuses, mm-hmm. you know, in their basement who talk about sex a lot, but you know they're not getting any.
Schwing.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Funny.
Yeah.
How do I relate? Well, I mean, I was the oldest of four children. My sister's a lesbian, and I have two brothers, so I just felt like one of the guys. You know, I think just coming up, I always had my head underneath the hood of a car. You know, mm-hmm. I can fix anything on a car, by the way, if anybody has a car breakdown. So, you know, I was just one of the dudes, you know, and I think that's probably why I do better with boy movies than girl movies. I mean, they sent me... You know, like, what was that? Legally Blonde, okay? And I read it, and I'm like, I don't get this. Yeah. You know, I really can't relate. And they hounded me to direct it, and I said, I'm sorry, I just don't understand. But I do better with dude movies. Yeah, I don't know why.
It's interesting, too, you know, talking about relating, because obviously you did the punk scene, but you had talked about in previous interviews, Penelope, about how Decline 2... Decline Part 2 about the metal scene in L.A. really helped create sort of a template for you for how to understand these two suburban dudes who were into this kind of metal-y music.
Mm-hmm. In Wayne's World.
In Wayne's World. What was that connection like? Did you feel like getting to know these L.A. scenesters on the Hollywood Strip trying to desperately get a record contract with the big hair, and they all looked alike in some ways, all behaved the same way. What was the connection between these two mythical guys who were in their Aurora basement?
Well, that is a very, very good question, and a very, which I say, astute to put those things together. But here's the thing, and I don't think I've ever told anybody this before. Wayne and Garth thought they were headbangers. I mean, like, their characters in the movie and kind of off camera as well. But having just stepped out of the real scene, I kind of had to like go along with it and go, yeah, sure, guys, you're headbangers. Yeah, sure.
But not really.
But I knew that they're not the real thing, but I was just sort of going along with it. And maybe that's part of what made the charm happen. I don't know.
Well, what you're getting at, I think, is a sort of naive innocence. They were fans, and they were trying to act like these heroes that they saw on the TV screen, but they really couldn't be those guys ever, and that was the joy of it. Right?
Neither Wayne nor Garth would ever be Gene Simmons.
No, and I think you hit on something there, because people always ask, you know, what is it about Wayne's World? And I think it is that innocence. It's that joie de vivre, if you want to say it, where, you know, you're at a certain age and you think the whole world is butterflies and flowers, and it's, you know, you're going to just go out there and live the most wonderful life ever, and then you start to learn about reality. But before that, before that, you're like Wayne and Garth, and really, really optimistic, and I think it's their optimism that is their charm.
Okay, I still live with my parents, which I admit is both bogus and sad. But at least I've got an amazing cable access show, and I still know how to party. But what I'd really love is to do Wayne's World for a living. It might happen. Yeah, and monkeys might fly out of my butt.
Yeah, and the fandom. You know, they live for this
music. And
that
they're fans. Yeah, and you know, when we took it, like when I took out Decline on the road recently and to the theatrical art house circuit, people would come up to me and honestly, that sometimes they would be crying. They would put their arms around me and say, thank you, thank you, thank you for helping me. Thank you for doing the movie and helping me figure out who I was when I couldn't do it.
Yeah, yeah. Because it was harder when those movies came out, to connect with these worlds. If you weren't living somewhere hip like New York or Los Angeles, you're living in Montana, this is going to open your eyes.
Well, on that box that we did, and I'm not trying to sell them, believe me, but Dave Grohl does the voiceover for Decline One, and he said that's what happened to him, is his cousin, he went and visited his cousin in a different state, and she was like, hey, man, come here, I got to show you this thing. It was like contraband, you know? And it had a video cassette of the first Decline. It was like, check this out, and it was like really opened his eyes, and that's why he's got Pat Smear in his band, you know?
Right. He has told that story. Actually, she lived in Chicago. He came here.
See, it's the truth.
Yeah.
After the break, we'll be back with more of our conversation with Penelope Spheeris, where we'll discuss that iconic Bohemian Rhapsody headbanging scene. Later, Jim's going to put a quarter into the Desert Island Jukebox. Jim, what do you got for us?
Greg, I have one of the best songs of teenage angst and melodrama ever. I don't even want to tip my hand yet.
That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. The situation.
I think we'll go with a little Bohemian Rhapsody, gentlemen.
Good call.
I see a little silhouette of a man.
Scaramouche, Scaramouche, will you do the fandango?
Thunderbolt and lightning, very, very frightening me.
Galileo.
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 Galileo. Figaro.
I'm just a poor boy.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot with Jim DeRogatis, and that's part of the Bohemian Rhapsody scene from the 1992 film Wayne's World. Everybody loves that scene. Directed by our guest today, Penelope Spheeris. 25 years later, this movie is still extremely beloved, especially because of that goofy moment in Garth's Pacer, the Mirthmobile, seeing Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody.
I almost owned a Pacer at one point.
Once you're in that scene, you cannot stop watching that movie. Now, we had read that scene almost didn't happen, so we asked Penelope whether that was true.
No, not at all. Huh?
Good.
No.
I love to debunk these stories. Because the story goes you wanted Guns N' Roses and Myers pushed for Queen.
That's hilarious. You know why that's hilarious? Because it is so opposite of true. Here's the thing. Guns N' Roses were supposed to be in decline too, and they were going to close the movie. And their manager pulled out at the last second, and I was so Slash was down with it. Axl was down with it. It was all going to happen, and they pulled out. And therefore, I got Megadeth, okay? So I do Wayne's World as my next movie. Now, do you think that I'm going to go and ask Guns N' Roses to be in my effing movie? I don't think so.
Yeah. The hell with them.
And, screw those dudes. And actually, lately, I saw Slash, and he apologized that they, didn't do it. But, life is what it is. But no, if somebody made that story up, sounds like Mike or something. But I never wanted Guns N' Roses in the movie. Aerosmith.
And he wanted Aerosmith.
Well, for the performance piece, that Alice did. And they appeared in the second one.
Mm-hmm.
That I did not appear in.
A vastly inferior sequel.
Yeah, nobody remembers that movie, Penelope.
Nobody, so, no. There should not have been a Wayne's World 2, no.
Well, not so quick anyway,
Yeah. All right, so was it your idea for Bohemian Rhapsody from the beginning?
No, it wasn't my idea. And see, that's the thing about punk rockers. See, I told you I'm a punk rocker at heart. We tell the truth, okay? I ain't flowering nothing up here. It was not my idea. It was Mike's idea, and it was written into the script when I got the script, and I shot it. I will say this. He wasn't real happy when I made him bang his head for 6 hours.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he did, I have read that.
And he did maintain that it wasn't funny, but the fact is he was being a good actor, and he followed the direction, and he did it, and it's the scene everybody remembers.
Yeah, it wouldn't work without the head banging. That's absolutely necessary.
Yeah, that was critical.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Definitely. Well, the song is too long. You got to do something. It's like nine minutes long,
So you think you can stone me and spit in my eye? So you think you can love me and leave me to die?
Garth.
Did you relate to the song? Because, the one thing that I think was extraordinary about that is it basically gave Queen a second life. I mean, Freddie Mercury was dying. The band was effectively a non-entity for a number of years on the charts. And that sent them, that started a whole new round of Queen appreciation and sales.
I mean, it sold records.
That's not the kind of song that you'd put in there and saying, people are going to instantly relate to this, because that song really hadn't been part of the culture for a number of years. I mean, it was a 70s hit. So how did you think that was going to work in that scene? This is a critical scene.
Well,
you're setting the stage for this movie.
To answer your first question, yes, I always loved Queen. And I didn't even question that it would work in the film. I didn't think it would work as well as it did. That's for darn sure.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the thing about the movie and the music. It It all came together in some sort of magical way where the planets were lined up right, the chemistry of the right people were together, everybody was at the peak of their game. You know, it just, there's very seldom in life did things line up like that. Wayne's World was a magical moment. And this guy says to me, he goes, don't you think that just because you had that big hit with Wayne's World that every movie you do now is going to be a big hit like that? And I thought, you watch me, brother. But here's the thing. He was right. It's a kind of thing. It only happens once in a lifetime, I think. And, you know, I certainly don't take credit for the whole movie or for any of it, really. I mean, I was in the right place at the right time.
My name is Wayne Campbell. I live in Aurora, Illinois, which is a suburb of Chicago. Excellent.
Other rumors about the movie, okay? A lot of people we talk to still think that movie was shot in Aurora, Illinois, the suburb.
I feel so bad for them.
They embrace it because it's the, you know, they're wearing the Blackhawks jerseys when they're playing street hockey. So they think this is a Chicago movie.
You know what? I got in trouble recently because I heard, you know, they did the re-release of the DVDs in February. And I heard they were having a celebration in Aurora. And I thought, that's great. I'm so happy about that. And then I heard it was going to be a six-month celebration.
Oh, man.
And it was going to end on July 4th. And I thought, with a headbanging contest. And I said publicly, and I'm actually embarrassed that I said it, but I'm going to say it again just to make sure I'm really embarrassed. I said, don't they have any strawberries or pumpkins to celebrate? And I got in trouble for that. So I want to officially apologize to all you Auroraans.
Now, Myers has said, apparently, his suburban upbringing in Canada evoked this kind of a scene to him. Do you have a sense of why Aurora was the spot where mythically he was going to be doing this show from?
I remember them saying, we have to just get something that is so typically suburban, and what could it be? And there was a bunch of talk about it, you know. And actually, the funniest thing was the writers and Mike were so concerned about the look of the house that Mike lived in. And I must have looked at 50 houses in the valley, you know, out here, not in Aurora. And they all look alike. Okay, exactly, alike. And I just picked one. What the hell? I'll just take this one. And so everybody, like, tries to find that house now. I think it's cool. It's actually a really, really big compliment that people care that much about the movie. And I know that there's, like, a website that shows where all the locations really were. And, you know, I'm proud that people think it was shot in Aurora because that means, you know, we did a good job as filmmakers.
There are a lot of memorable cameos in Wayne's World. Chris Farley, Alice Cooper, Ed O'Neill. But I want to take a minute to talk about Meatloaf. He makes an appearance in the film as a bouncer outside a club. How did you come up, Penelope, with the idea of putting the immortal Meatloaf in your movie?
You know, I was actually at a party before Meatloaf became really, really famous, and he was there, and he was wearing this big trench coat, and there was a whole bunch of, like, buffet-type food on the table, and I watched him pick up pork chops and put
in his pockets.
Pocket.
Yeah.
We were trying to find little cameos, you know, and it could have well been my idea to have Meatloaf in there. I'm not going to take credit for it because I'm not 1,000% sure. But we just wanted little cameos all along the place, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, Meatloaf.
Wait!
Hey.
How you doing?
Hey.
Garth!
Hey, Tiny, who's playing tonight?
Jolly Green Giants. Beatles.
The Beatles, are they any good?
They suck.
That it's not just a clever name.
How about Alice Cooper, We're Not Worthy, and that whole thing? It's just so brilliant.
Well, you know, I had just worked with Alice doing a music video for my old buddy, God bless him, Wes Craven, for that Shocker video. And I worked with Alice, and I worked with Dave Mustaine there. And I had worked with Alice and wanted to have him in the film because Aerosmith didn't want to do the movie because I think they didn't think it was very cool.
Whereas Alice has a great sense of humor.
Well, that's the thing is, man, we slammed him with, like, you know, two pages of dialogue. He thought he was just going to sit there and look freaky and then sing a song, which he's really good at doing both, but then he had to do the dialogue. But, you know, he stepped it up.
Alice,
Is this cool?
Yeah, come on in.
Sorry to bother you, but we had to come and tell you how much we really enjoyed the show, didn't we, Garth?
Oh, thanks.
We're not mental or anything, so don't be afraid. We're not worthy! We're not worthy!
But lately, I talked to Alice, and he told me after all these years, he was a little bit upset about something in the movie.
Mm.
And I said, my goodness, we never want to upset Alice. What was it? And he goes, that you put a snake on Cassandra.
Oh.
And I'm like, oh, man, we totally blew it. You're right. It was a total subconscious decision. We weren't trying to rip you off, man.
I wanted to riff on that because you're dropping these names like Alice and Meatloaf and you mentioned Axel and Slash like they were personal friends of yours. And
oh, yeah,
How did you relate to all these characters? I mean, they're not people that let you into their world that easily, you know? And yet you seem to have developed a relationship with all of them.
Yeah, because I'm not the hottest taco on the fiesta platter, okay? So they don't really look at me like they're going to get laid later. And that's really back in those days, that's what it was all about.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, you know, they just kind of, I just dress in a black leather jacket and black, I don't do it up, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so they just kind of treat me like one of the guys. And that's fine with me because I can get my work done that way.
Well, it certainly holds up. I mean, you know, it's one of those movies where I think it was kind of thought of as maybe a goof, you know, at the start, and now it's become this iconic film for multiple generations of people, you know?
I know.
You know, to the point where people are dressing up like the characters in a way that's sort of timeless, you know?
But it really sounds like you were saying, Penelope, that Decline 1 is the one that you'd rather, you'd have first on your tombstone.
Oh, yeah, for sure, definitely. Yeah. I'm gonna back that up. Decline 3. Because for me, Decline 3 is, I don't know, the most important movie I've made just because of the social statement with regard to homeless kids out on the street.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And so, also that's where I met the love of my life, Sin, S-I-N. And he's from Florida, and he was a train-riding gutter punk. And let me tell you something. I sure did learn a lot about just survivalism. I'm a survivalist after being with him for 20 years.
I need no
luxury and want no luxury.
I got you. Well, yeah, that's where you started, and then you wind up back there.
Yeah, I'm comfortable being poor, even though I have like a load of money. I'm really comfortable being poor. Can I swear? I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah, it's public radio.
It's fine.
Oh, yeah.
It has been a complete honor and privilege talking to Penelope Spheeris. Thank you so much, Penelope.
Oh, thank you, guys. And Chicago, do rock on. Excellent. Okay, guys, party on.
That wraps up our conversation with the brilliant Penelope Spheeris, and now we want to hear from you. Do you have a favorite scene in Wayne's World? What is it, and why do you love it? Call 888-859-1800 and leave us a message.
I tell you, little buddy, this whole island is bewitched. Just a castaway, island lost at sea. Now I'm stranded on my own.
Stranded far from home. But come on. You remember, we were shipwrecked together.
As often as possible, we like to take a trip to the desert island. Speeding out there at this very moment is Jim DeRogatis to play a track he cannot live without. Jim, what do you got?
I can't live without it, but you may well be able to. You know, though I often mention the name Meatloaf on this show, especially in relation to Bruce Springsteen, I went back in the archives and I very seldom have actually played the music of Meatloaf. And there are two good reasons to do it. One, we had just been talking to Penelope Spheeris about that Meatloaf cameo in Wayne's World. The other is you weren't there, but everyone else on the Sound Opinion staff, we had a family band night because two of our producers have musical projects and I, you know, play drums in a punk rock band. So all the bands played at the Hideout and we had a great time. But Evan Chung blew my mind. He is a fantastic bassist, and he had a, what was it, 6 or 7-piece Meatloaf tribute band. I'm telling you, Cott, they played Paradise by the Dashboard Light, and it was perfect. All right? I had actually forgotten. I think I have come to love Meatloaf since discovering him at age 13. I've come to forget that every Meatloaf song is approximately 7.5 times longer than it should be, and there's about 13 false endings. I'm telling you, they had every one. They had every false ending, every crescendo, every cliche. So I got to play some Meatloaf. I'm sorry. You know, they pointed out on stage, and I think they were quoting me as they did it, that Todd Rundgren, who produced this record, one of the giant producers of all time, very consciously saw it as an answer record to Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run. Now, Springsteen is doing teen melodrama and angst in a 50s-based, blown-up-to-operatic Phil Spector way, right? Meatloaf is doing that, but they're a cartoon. You know, Springsteen was serious about it. At least Rundgren and Max Weinberg and Roy Bittan from the E Street Band, who play on the record. You know, I think they all saw The Loaf as a cartoon. I know that Rundgren's bandmates in Utopia, who completed the band, Kasim Sultan, Roger Powell, Willie Wilcox, right? They all saw this as a cartoon, and it was a fantastic cartoon. I don't know. Marvin Lee a Day probably took it seriously. Certainly Jim Steinman, who wrote it all, right, took it seriously. But I don't know how you take Meatloaf seriously. I'm going to play All Revved Up with No Place to Go, and I will stay out on this limb that Meatloaf is better than Springsteen and even go further. I don't know, Greg, if there is better writing in the opening of any rock song ever. I was nothing but a lonely boy looking for something new, and you were nothing but a lonely girl, but you were something, something like a dream come true. I mean, that's, you know what I mean? That's profound, brother.
When you're 13, that is profound.
Well,
you're
it's profound at soon to be 53. I make no apologies for loving the loaf. Here it is, All Revved Up with No Place to Go. This one's for Evan on Sound Opinions. Up with No Place to Go from Meatloaf's immortal classic, Bat Outta Hell, 1977. I won't go near Bat Outta Hell 2. Edgar Winter on saxophone on that song. I didn't even know he played sax. What do we have on the show next week, Mr. Cott?
Next week, Jim, we are digging up some buried treasures. We're going to play some music that's under the mainstream radar, but that we can't live without.
Greg, as always, we have some thank yous to say. Sound Opinions is produced by Brendan Banaszak, Evan Chung, Alex Claiborne, Ayana Contreras, and our intern, Isabella Martin.
Here I go again, dialing your number. Lady, how you just won't pick up the phone. Pick up the phone, boy, pick up the phone.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So now it's time to hear what you have to say.
New messages.
This is Matt from Langhorne, Pennsylvania, calling in response to your last episode, more specifically the choice of review, that being the new Public Enemy album. We're in a really good year for hip-hop, and in the last couple weeks to a month, there have been some pretty amazing albums in the genre. for example, a late career gem from Jay-Z. Cry tears of joy when you fell in love. Don't matter to me if it's a him or her. I just want to see you smile through all the hate. Maria Antoinette, baby, let her meet Kate. The new Tyler, the Creator album, the new Vince Staples album, which has some of the most just mind-melting production you'll hear all year. And yet, you haven't reviewed any of these. And yet, you do decide to review a couple of dinosaurs who have nothing really to say anymore. You know, just my opinion. Love the show. Keep it up. You guys rock. Thanks. Elvin songs and endless nights, sweet wine and soft, relaxing lights. Hi, this is Tom from Hastings on Hudson, New York, and I appreciated your show on fantasy and rock and roll, and I wanted to recommend the Rush song Rivendell. Many people, when they think of Rush, they think of the epic fantasy tunes and suites from the early and middle part of Rush's career, but early on the Fly By Night record, they had a beautiful, moving little song called Rivendell. Please, you can escape the world where the dark lord cannot go. I was a teenager getting into Rush. My friends and I were really intrigued with this song. It was kind of a deep track for us, a secret favorite for us. You would never put it on in the presence of other people, but when you got together with hardcore young Rush fans, it was always like, oh, Rivendell, what's going on with that song? Isn't that a very special little thing? I love the show, and I appreciate the increasing number of Rush references in the last several years.
This is Saul calling from Philadelphia. Recently heard your episode about fantasy and music. One that you may have overlooked or forgotten about was Christopher Lee's heavy metal album that he recorded about King Charlemagne. Definitely worth investigating. Thank you for your time, and I'll be seeing you. Bye.
I shed the blood of the Saxon man.
Paul calling from Philly about fantasy and records and music. Suzanne Vega, her first album, just about every song on that thing is some type of fantasy, including one about a relationship between a medieval queen and a medieval common soldier. And it's a beautiful album, everything about it. Suzanne Vega, first album. Thank you.
The soldier came knocking upon the queen's door. He said, I am not fighting for you anymore. And the queen knew she'd seen his face someplace before. And slowly she led him inside. He said, I've watched your...
Morning, guys. This is Brian in Beverly Hills, Michigan. I was out for a run listening to your podcast on fantasy music. And I flash back to 1975. My high school girlfriend was an absolute Uriah Heep freak, so I got tickets to go see them at Cobo Hall in Detroit, and her favorite album by them, and actually one of my favorites that's pretty obvious fitting into this category, Demons and Wizards, and the song The Wizard on that album. We had a great time at the concert. I still remember it to this day, although I have no idea where my high school girlfriend is. Thanks a lot. Appreciate the show.
No more messages.
To share your opinions on Sound Opinions, call 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.